Okay, should we start? So my name is Saurabh Kaul, and I want to thank Vile and Dan for the invitation and for putting on this really, really unique and kind of cool program over the last many, many weeks. I wish I could stay for longer, but it's been great to be here. And I should also thank Ben for really setting up a lot of the concepts that I'll be talking about throughout the talk. So Ben alluded to this actually elegant synthesis of cancer populations and the depiction of populations as clones that in the evolutionary theory of tumor cell populations. And this theory is quite important because it predicts certain characteristics of tumors, and one is that certainly they will be composed of heterogeneous clonal populations. And likely, these are genotypic and phenotypic populations that by the time we diagnose these cancers, they will have diverged in such a way. And it introduces a formalism for trying to describe this population dynamics in the sense of phylogenetics. And we'll get into a lot of that aspect of how well phylogenetics can actually model these populations over the course of the talk. And perhaps the important thing about this is that these are dynamic systems that will evolve in both space and over time. And so these are all elements that we'll touch on. And you can imagine that you could have a tumor that maybe it's composed of such clones, and over time it changes and morphs into something that exists, and perhaps with the addition of a selective pressure. So the key questions really that underpin all this is do these genotypes drive different phenotypic behaviors? And what we really care about is how this relates to treatment response, metastasis, progression, etc. And so we've been thinking a long time about how to measure this, and the advent of next generation sequencing devices has really changed the whole game in terms of being able to look at fixed genetic marks in populations with these devices. And so it's very well appreciated that the scalability of next gen sequencing has made whole genome sequencing accessible for the first time to many sets of patients. But maybe what's less well appreciated is actually the nature of the technology is digital in that sense. And so whereas Sanger sequencing is analog and we really do get this average signal out, next-gen sequencing is digital. And the advantage of that is that when we're sequencing a mixture, and Ben alluded to the fact that that's in fact what we're doing, we're sequencing mixtures, the alleles of a particular mutation are represented in some proportion, and we can estimate maybe that proportion is gives us some notion of what proportion of cells that harbor that particular mutation. And so when we do very deep sequencing of a particular allele, we can get very precise and exquisite quantification of what proportion of alleles in our soup actually harbor a mutation. We can take advantage of that in terms of trying to understand the dynamics of a tumor, especially if we have we're looking at a tumor as it changes over time or as it changes in space. So the first so this invokes multiple experimental designs for studying the dynamics of tumors using mutations as clonal marks. So first, as you can imagine, that we're sequencing a single sample, and this is really a lot of the work that Ben showed is exactly analogous to this situation. We've got a sample, we know it's made up of a mixture of populations, and we want to try to infer something about what populations may be present. And so another scenario is when we want to look at multiple samples at the same time. So at the time of surgical staging, for example, you can harvest multiple metastatic deposits, and I'm sure Marco Gerlinger talked a lot about this last week, where we can harvest these particular materials and then ask essentially what are the dynamics of clones in space. And then We could also imagine a time series type of scenario where here we're measuring a population at one time and then measuring it at another time, and maybe there's some sort of selective pressure that's introduced here. We can ask how much it changes in the presence of that selective pressure. And then finally, we can get into single nucleus sequencing. We're actually taking direct measurements of single cells and ask what is the composition of the population by actually completely deconvoluting and reconstructing a hierarchy from single cells. And so this is developing, and we have some preliminary work on this that I'll show you today. Okay, so our first attempt at this, or it's a bit of a busy slide, was actually 5 years ago. We started sequencing a metastatic lobular breast cancer, and it was a pleurally fusion, so an ER-positive cancer, and we sequenced the whole genome, and then we asked, we had the primary tumor in the tumor bank. There was a 9-year interval between the primary tumor and its recurrence. And so we sequenced the tumor and looked at coding mutations, and we found that there are 32 mutations in the metastatic tumor, and then we looked backwards using this targeted sequencing technique and asked what mutations were actually present in the original tumor. And we found that actually only 5 of those 32 mutations were present, and that included these 5 here. And that 6 mutations, because we were able to quantify the prevalence of those mutations in the primary, were actually emergent. So these were subclonal in the primary. And then the rest of the mutations were actually completely absent. There were just no sign of them whatsoever. So this gave us the first really confidence that we could use this, it's a proof of principle study more than anything, that we could actually use this technology to infer something about how tumor populations are changing over time. This is a large interval, and there's radiotherapy involved as well. So but this is really just a technical, I would say, proof of principle that we can measure evolution by looking at these fixed sets of mutations. So now I'll just talk a little bit about some of the methodological advances. So half of my lab does computational methods development. Yes?
Can I say another? How many?
We'll get to that type of comparison in a minute. This was really the first time we sequenced we only had budget to sequence the one tumor, and then we did targeted sequencing of the parameters. Only a look backwards, not a look forward. So I'll spend a bit of time on methodological advances, but Ben, I think, really covered the ground extremely well, and so I'll be a bit brief about this. But I think one of the key concepts is that when we do this targeted deep sequencing, so we might get 1,000 or 10,000x coverage, and we can look at the prevalence of a particular mutation in a population of reads, that signal arises from multiple different components. So first is maybe the proportion of non-malignant cells, and this can be lymphocytes, or they can be stroma, or they can be other non-malignant cells. And then we have the actual population structure. So, for example, if we're looking at perhaps a mutation that forms this orange clone here, then that will have a certain prevalence in the population. And if it was rather this light blue clone, that will have a different prevalence. So the population structure determines this measurement as well. And then finally, we have this concept of mutational genotype. So one of the questions earlier was, what happens when you have copy number changes? Well, that actually influences the allelic fraction that we measure. So you can imagine that in the basic scenario, where we have a diploid genome that is mutated in 100% of cells, the allelic fraction should be 50%. It's a heterozygous mutation hitting one allele. And then, of course, you can have loss of heterozygosity of the wild-type allele, and that would yield a allelic fraction of 100%. We can also have a situation where we have aneuploidy or segmental amplifications that may happen first. So for example, if this allele is amplified and then we have a mutation, then that would result in an allelic fraction of 25%. So these three, this is quite simplistic, there's probably other factors happening as well, but these are three main components that we tried to model using a Bayesian probabilistic approach. So we developed this model called PyClone, which Ben alluded to, and it's a hierarchical Bayes statistical model. I'm not going to go into too much detail except to say that what we try to do is model these three components, mutational genotype, the prevalence of a mutation, and then do that simultaneously, and the number of clusters, which mutations co-occur. The output looks something like this. Well, it's not a very good slide. Ben's slide is much better, actually. maybe I can borrow that from you. So what this shows is the rows are mutations, and along the y-axis here is the prevalence of that, the inferred prevalence of that mutation, as well as it's corrected for copy number change. And so we have a cluster of mutations here that's high prevalence, and this includes P53. So you'd expect that this is an early event, and then it gets propagated forward. And then we have these waves of clonal expansion that could potentially explain a tree structure. And Ben has taken the next step then, is trying to actually put that tree structure on this type of data. Okay, and so we did a fair amount of benchmarking. This is actually semi-synthetic data, where this is the ground truth, where we're showing the expected prevalence of particular groups of mutations. So these lines represent clusters of mutations that are grouped together in their expected prevalence, and these shift in different mixture populations that we generated. And this is the inferred prevalence here. So it looks like it matches quite well. This is published earlier this year. Okay, and so we've also done the analogous thing in copy number, and I think really not going to spend much time on this, except to just refer you to this paper that describes the Titan model. And so if you have interest in maybe contrasting what Ben has done with what we've done with what Villay has done, then this is the reference here. And so we took a Bayesian approach where we developed a generative hidden Markov model to try to model both the B alleles and the copy number simultaneously as a function of essentially signal strength. And then we think that signal strength is actually proportional to the prevalence of that event in the population. So I think I'll just keep it short and sweet and refer you to the paper. So those are some of the statistical modeling methods. And so what I wanted to really focus on for the most of the time, though, is some of the experiments that we've been doing to track clonal expansions. And I think this is quite relevant to a lot of the discussions that have been happening throughout the week. So we've been engaged. This is joint work with Sam Aparicio, who's the chair of breast cancer research at the BC Cancer Agency. So we've been engaged in taking patient tumor samples and engrafting them into immunodeficient mice, and doing essentially serial passaging of those xenografts over time, and also then in these branches represent different mice where we get replicates of the same material going into different mice. And so these are locally advanced breast cancers, and they come from surgical resection, often some metastatic cancers as well. What else can I say about this? Is that we try to avoid the concept of spatial heterogeneity in this study by actually doing an important step, which is to take the large piece of tissue and actually just kind of disaggregate it so that we get hopefully sample some of the spatial heterogeneity that may exist. So we hope that we're actually engrafting a mixed population right from the beginning, and then we can observe how that population changes over time when you actually put this into the mouse. Okay. Yes?
Do you have multiple mice with the same tumor so that you can watch it parallel evolving, or is it one?
I'll show you some data. Okay, so the first the technique we're using here is whole genome sequencing. So we sequence the whole genome. Initially, we sequence the whole genome of the patient sample, and then we sequence the whole genome of the resulting xenograft. Sometimes it's the first passage, sometimes it's later passages, but we always study the intervening passages as well. And I'll show you how we do that. So what here it just shows a heat map of cellular prevalence. It's just allelic fraction. So what you might expect is that if the mutations are shared, then they should just lie on the diagonal of this. So this is the tumor, this is a xenograft, and so you would see a tight correlation of mutations that are shared. But what we observe is that there's a fair number of mutations on the axes here. So these would be mutations that are very low allelic fraction in the tumor, but then emerge in the xenograft. And here you have mutations that are very low in the xenograft, but were there in the tumor. So these are likely representing clones that don't engraft at all. So we're using these mutations as marks of clones.
You're defining mutations based on a comparison to germline?
Exactly. These are all somatic mutations. We sequence a normal blood as well. Okay. So then we can actually sample from this distribution. We can sample from this distribution.
Sorry, one more question on that. You're taking xenografts out of mice. What are you doing with the mouse sequences?
Yeah, so we actually we've sequenced the host as well, the actual host, just once, not every time, and created and actually aligned that to the human genome. So we create a mutation mask, if you will, of variants that are likely arising from mouse tissue, and so then any variants that are in that mask we just remove. There are more elegant ways to do that, but that's the way we end up doing it.
So it's exforming the fourth pathway?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
And so the mouse genotype is invariant. You take the tumor out and put it into a fresh mouse.
Yeah, and it's this. So the first engraftment happens, and then the engraftment takes, and then at some point you have to sacrifice the mouse because the tumor grows, and you just keep propagating forward.
So the tumor is evolving, but the host is not.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yes. How big is the tumor when you transfer it?
I think it's. I'm not sure about that. Actually, having not actually done that work myself.
So,
just
trying to understand what you explained. So there is presumably a serious sampling issue, right? Because very few sample that actually. Right? So presumably there are lots of very low frequency alleles in the tumor that would not particularly show up in high frequency.
So this is a really, really important point. So to address that, we engaged in deep targeted sequencing. So this is just the next step. So I probably shouldn't have shown this at first. But what we did then is we sampled from this distribution. And so this represents thousands of mutations. So this is probably it's on the order of 10,000 mutations. So then what we did is sampled hundreds of mutations from this distribution, so that we had some representation of what that looks like, and then did targeted deep sequencing, so to get allelic precision on those mutations, and then we put that data through PyClone. So that we can resolve the copy number issues and the normal contamination issues to actually estimate the cellular prevalence. And then that's what this output here is. And so what PyClone has done is cluster these mutations into groups. And so up here there's a group. This is a group that is at prevalence 100% in both the xenograft and the tumor. And so these are presumably ancestral mutations. So these belong on the trunk of a tree that Ben would draw, for example. But then you see that there is really this pattern is confirmed where we see mutations here. Here's a cluster of 12 mutations that's at about 50% prevalence in the tumor, but doesn't engraft. It just doesn't expand in the mouse at all. So that one is left behind. And then you have these other populations where you have their very low prevalence in the tumor, and then they expand dramatically. So we capture these alleles because we're actually sequencing the xenograft as well, and then we can look in both directions and ask, how prevalent was it in the tumor to begin with? And the answer is it was a very, very low prevalence. So just looking at the tumor and xenograft, so tumor and one xenograft passage, we can get a picture that looks like this. And the initial impression is that this is one of the more extreme examples, is that the xenograft actually, the clonal expansions are quite different than what the source tumor is in the first place. So then what happens over serial passages? So this is just essentially one time point. So you've got the tumor and you've got the xenograft. And what happens in terms of stability? So if we look at this, now we've done deep sequencing on multiple serial passages. We take the same set of mutations, and then we deep sequence multiple serial passages, and we can ask whether the prevalence of particular alleles changes over time. And so here we can see that this set of mutations here, this is that initial set that was very low in the tumor, expands to almost dominate the xenograft. Here, that actually remains stable, so that population doesn't decline. But what we see is the emergence over time of this population here, that's just represented by five mutations. The content is not necessarily relevant here, it's just about the fact that we're using these as markers. And so you can see this expansion from between X3 and X4 of this particular clone. So in fact, this is actually one of the more relatively stable tumors. So here you see, for example, you have an expansion where we have a clone that's actually has a commensurate decline in the context of this one. So this answers your question about earlier. So you should see competition where you have if you see an expansion of one clone, you should actually see decline in something else. And so we do observe that for the most part.
Is that emergent clone X4 present in extremely small proportion of the primary, or is it?
That's right, yeah. So it is there, but it's very, very low, yes.
So you illustrate this issue of competition, and does this really demonstrate that there's competition, that something is going down?
So I think if you could isolate these populations and then manipulate them, then you could actually measure that. But that's actually to disaggregate populations is quite difficult. We're still working with bulk here, so it's really an inference. It's kind of it's a bit hand-wavy, I agree. But we often see these lines crossing, and so that gives us some indication that there are populations that are outcompeting others, and the expansion of one is associated with the decline of another. Whether it actually is competition is.
Can you correct?
Both populations could be wrong.
Right. They could.
So exactly. Can you correct for total cell number? So I mean, you're presenting percentages here. So one can't go up without the other going down.
Yeah.
But it could be that the one that you're showing going down is growing at exactly
the
same rate.
Yeah, that's actually quite important. I think we haven't really done that, but I think that would be important.
Could you do it?
So we're still dealing with mixtures, and so when we do this deep sequencing, the best you can do is as actually. So maybe that's where single cell would really help. Let me just think through this.
Really normalize the total number of
This is what PyClone is doing. Is normalizing for that, and so you actually get relative proportions.
Actually, can you normalize to the total DNA content in the tumor? So if you just homogenize the tumor and ask on a per mass basis what the total DNA content is, assuming that the ploidy is not changing, and then ask normalize to that. So as a fraction of total DNA, will that work?
That's essentially
as a cell measure.
We don't explicitly do that, but that's what the readout essentially is.
But you're still presenting it as a percentage. I'm asking for absolutes. Think about the way you think about reticulocyte counts in a human, right? You present it as a percentage. But unless you correct it for total cell number, you don't actually know what the reticulocyte.
Next gen's still approaching single molecule sequencing. I think you'd have to actually do single molecule sequencing to get that and be able to identify the individual molecules, because otherwise you still can only count something as the mutation is a fraction of the total number of reads that you acquire. So the total number of reads that you acquire is not a function of the total DNA content. It's a function of how much sequencing you do.
Well, how do you decide when to sacrifice the mouse? How big is the, in particular, how big is the tumor?
Yeah, I think we have specific protocols. I'm not able to answer that question.
I think that that's actually, it's at that level that the denominator in these fractions, in these percentages.
To estimate the total cell count.
Would be accessible.
Yeah, except the tumor size and tumor weight is difficult because tumors have different stromal, I mean, we do this a lot. They have different stromal components, they can bleed, you know, so the volume and the mass can change in a way that's not related to total cell number.
Yeah.
Depending on the compartment, the cells can become more compressed or less compressed. So we'll label with luciferase and use the luciferase signal as a measure of total cell number. But if you've got different clones, you actually need to know that one, you have similar luciferase expression in each clone, and that two, you actually have the same relationship between cell number and light generation, which is not
trivial.
This is why doing biology sucks. Doing the computational stuff.
So I mean, taking all these additional measurements would undoubtedly help this analysis. But for now, we're dealing with portions.
The other complexity is the fact that these are probably immunodeficient mice.
They are immunodeficient.
So some of the selection is really
absolutely. So but that is the selective pressure here, or the lack thereof. It's a pressure. You're taking this population out of the human. You're putting it in a different environment, and we're watching what happens. There's questions we can ask about that. So here's something that's actually quite complex. So here we have a situation where you have actually emergence of a population, and then it actually gets taken over by this green population here, and I'll show you some single cell data that validates this. So this is actually where you get. So here you have really subtle changes over time. Here you actually have quite dramatic changes over time, and this is actually without imposing any selective pressures whatsoever. It's just serial passaging. Yeah.
The last one is very beautiful because what I think first two are really nice, but there you don't have consistent progression between pathologies, but here you have two trajectories.
You have a trajectory. So if we had, let's say we had 10 data points, we may be able to actually model what the growth rate is. And that's, we don't have it, but it's proof of principle.
Sorry, just slightly vague on that. Can you just clarify what are the lines and say what's the
Thanks. So the lines represent mutation clusters inferred by PyClone. And the y-axis here represents the prevalence at each of the xenograft passages.
Okay. So it's sort of sweet in the green one.
Yeah,
but it's there's not a sweet.
It is actually. So the reason is because it's hierarchical. So this is not exactly the tree building that Ben's talking about. So in fact, and I'll show you this in the single cell data, is that the green actually inherits from the blue.
Okay, so
those mutations actually persist. They're not on different branches. They're not on different clades. They're actually descendant chains.
Okay. Yeah. And what about the traces that pass right through the green, like the yellow and the salmon?
This one here?
Yeah, for example.
Yeah, so this one here is probably noise. We don't actually believe this one.
Mm-hmm. What about the yellow one that's climbing and is almost unperturbed by green?
So that's a good question. So I'm not sure if we actually single cell sequence this. I'll have to look on the plot when we get there, but what happens with this one. But,
so when you do the clustering, are you doing it, it's multi-dimensional?
It's joint inference across the whole thing.
So that's
the power, which the big advance in the PyClone paper is actually to do this multiple sampling. And actually, so mutations that travel together as a function of the samples are much more likely to be in the same clone. And so that's actually borne out. So this doesn't tell you anything actually per se about the clonal composition. This tells you this gives you a hypothesis. But the actual co-occurrence of mutations can't really be ascertained until you get to single cell.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How much of the clusters change if you look at the inference across the whole set?
Well, the power is actually in the joint inference. So we did do some looking at pairs rather than the five, and that it tends to be stable, but it's far more accurate So we showed in the PyClone paper that if you do inference on single samples, it's less accurate than if you do joint inference. And that makes sense. You're just borrowing statistical strength across multiple measures. So it's less accurate. Okay, so these are the types of patterns we're observing. And so then you can ask, well, are these expansions somewhat stochastic or are they deterministic? And so what we did is actually repeat these experiments in multiple branches. So here what we have is every time you have a branch off, this is a biological replicate. So this is taking that same piece of tumor and then grafting it now into two mice, and then asking if that if we have the same observations. So taking the same population, grafting it independently into two mice, and then watching what happens. And for the most part, what we observe is that we observe very similar patterns. And so this gives us some notion that, in fact, these expansions are very likely deterministic. And whether they're epigenetically deterministic or whether they're genetically deterministic is unknown at this point. But the fact that we observe the same expansions tells us something that maybe in the patient, even in the patient population, that these expansions might very well happen. And so whether that actually mimics what's in a patient trajectory, we're just getting to the bottom of that now. So now we're starting to see some relapses come back from these very patients, and so we're going to actually be able to match that data with what we observe in the xenografts. But the fact that we see replicates showing the same patterns gives us some confidence, and certainly the reviewers in this paper a lot of confidence that these are actually real observations and they're non-stochastic.
But yeah. It tells you they are likely, but it doesn't tell you that they are deterministic.
That's true. I mean, it tells you that they're more likely to be deterministic. How about that? Okay, so deterministic is
too strong. Yes.
But they're not stochastic. They're reproducible. The concept of drift here doesn't really apply. But the word is that we're just observing some sort of drifting phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it gives us a lot of confidence.
They're selective.
Yes. So, well, again, that may be too strong too. So, reproducible selection maybe.
So you're taking a tumor and putting it into multiple mice.
Yes.
So you're taking different bits. The original tumor you're taking from is homogeneous?
And we try to alleviate sampling bias by essentially doing mechanical disruption of the tumor so that we get representation of the populations. But there's bound to be some sampling bias.
I think it's important, though, rather than thinking that it's necessarily selection, it may be the absence of selection, particularly immune selection, right? Or immune selective pressure. You removed a really important determinant of what's gonna grow. And you've imposed new selective pressures because it's a mouse.
Yeah.
I think
if you remove one selective pressure and there are other opportunities that are now available, which are favored by natural.
Okay.
Pressure. It's not immune selection, it's something else.
Yeah.
But I also, to your second point, I think I wonder whether you think if there are recurrences in the underlying patient, whether you think there's going to be any parallels.
I think it's going to be the green clone, to be honest. I think it's going to be this green clone.
Even though the green clone is responding to what emerges.
Yeah, because I think that that might have been there at very low proportion, but whatever it is driving that thing, it's taking over, it's dominating.
In the mouse.
That's my point. Yeah. So it may have
been suppressed.
And so what you see increasing, the greatest magnitude increase could be what reflects the absence of the selective pressure.
Yeah, sure. That's entirely possible. I completely subscribe to that.
Can you just explain about the color coding and this?
Oh, right. So these are actually two different hosts.
I see.
Yeah. So we actually were able to reproduce in two different hosts as well.
What I'm trying to get out of this is not necessarily the identity of some particular expanding clone, but the notion that there are multiple clones doing some fairly reproducible dynamics, which is making humans think that there is something vaguely deterministic about selective process that we're driving.
So here what we're doing is we're using, so ultimately we'd like to know the mechanism, but what we've done is sample from this distribution of mutations just to use heritable genetic marks as identifiers of the clones. And so the identity of the clones is determined by the mutations, and the content of the mutations here, we haven't taken that extra step to determine genome-wide what is actually driving that selection, or functionally what's driving that selection. But we have selected mutations that appear to be traveling together, and I can identify these clones in their dynamics. And
I'm just trying to draw attention to the fact that there are two different issues.
Mm-hmm.
One is whether whatever makes that green clone is the thing that drives the tumors, and then we can ask questions, is it driving tumors in immunocompromised mice or in humans, right? So the big issue is somebody wants to claim that that particular mutation is the driver of human cancer. Mm-hmm. But there is another statement here, that there is some generic process which one observes. And one can study, for example, by looking at the spreading of markers, which has to do with the dynamics of tumor progression, and maybe very universal, and apply conceivably pretty well to humans as to mice, right? But these are some of two different attitudes one can take.
Sure. I mean, the ultimate goal of this is really phase one. I'll get to the question. Phase one is to actually just show a proof of principle of the measurement technology in xenograft. And in fact, that we show that one of the most important observations is the fact that there is significant evolution that happens when you take a patient tumor and you graft it in a mouse. It is the, you know, it's a model that a lot of people use. And the assumption is that it's a faithful representation of the patient tumor. It may not be for the reasons that you alluded to, that these mice don't have immune systems, and so clones can grow out that wouldn't normally grow up. And the next phase is to actually impose selective pressure. So we want to do drug selection experiments, but knowing what the baseline is quite important, actually. So when you graft in the first place, the population dynamics change. And so you're not dealing with what's in the patient tumor, you're dealing with what's in the xenograft.
But what would be interesting is for those clones whose growth doesn't change by xenografting, because those are clones presumably that are highly adaptable. I would go so far as to suggest that those are the ones that are going to come back in the patient, because those are the ones that are unaffected by the enormous change in environment from from the human to the mouse,
yeah,
right?
Remains to be seen.
But what was your engraftment rate?
So it's a good question. So there's an unequal distribution amongst the breast cancers. So the triple negatives engraft at higher rates, mm-hmm. HER2 positives engraft at higher rates, and metastatic tumors engraft at higher rates. So it's somewhere around 30-40%.
Yeah, we found that with lung cancers that were resected for cure, the ones that engrafted in mice did way poor.
Yeah.
Those patients.
Yeah. It's the high mitotic.
Their tumor was that adaptable?
Exactly.
They did very poorly.
Yeah.
As a group.
So in the
GBM world, it's actually the CD133 fraction that's highly predictive of how well it'll xenograft and how quickly it'll come back.
Yeah. So it's an unequal distribution.
So you may talk about this later, but when you just average it all out, does it still look like the original tumor or not? Because there have been studies where they've done serial passaging using DNA sequencing and expression profiling where the tumor still stays stable.
Oh, from a phenotypic perspective?
A year later than, yeah.
So this, in this particular study, we actually haven't actually done the gene expression yet, so whether that remains to be
just to see if I have this right, so from this conversation, so it seems like to me this is very, very cool because fitness in any context is a product of multiple, fitness is multiple, multi-dimensional. Mm-hmm. I think you've isolated one of those dimensions. It may not be all of the dimensions that occur within a tumor, but by putting it in mouse, I can have kind of one of these components.
Maybe that's a longer discussion.
I didn't mean a question.
Just we are on the same page, and this is really following the board the same. For your purposes, all these colors and these mutations, they're just markers, and you make no statement whether they are functional or not.
Correct. Yeah. I think we'd have to observe something many, many times, hundreds of cases to do functional studies to determine that. So okay, so now let's switch now. There's been some discussion about single cell sequencing. So we've taken a targeted approach to this, so not whole genome, but rather targeted sequencing. We've taken some of these same alleles that we've predicted from whole genome sequencing and done this targeted sequencing in bulk, and asked whether mutations that cluster together by these trajectories actually co-occur in single cells. And so here's this sort of lightish blue clone up here, and that's represented with a few mutations here. And then we have this darker blue, still light blue, but a different darker blue, which is this set of mutations here. So here the columns are mutations, the rows are actual individual nuclei, and then this shows the xenograft in black cells, and the white cells are from the tumor. And the other clone, the other set of mutations, which is important, is this gray set, which we think represents the ancestral set of mutations. And so, and then we finally have these ones over here, which are germline polymorphisms. So, germline polymorphisms are present everywhere. Then we have the ancestral block of mutations, not present in these cells up here. So these are presumably normal cells. So we just actually put those aside. And then we ask from the malignant cells what's going on. These are mutations that are largely present in all cells. And so this represents this ancestral block. And then you have these blue mutations here, this block here, which are really confined to the tumor. And so that's what's predicted here, is that you have, at the tumor, you have very high prevalence of these mutations. And it basically drops to zero once you engraft. So that's a clone that does not engraft at all in the xenograft. And so when we look at the xenograft, those mutations are mostly absent, almost completely absent. And then you have the mutations that represent this expanded clone of the xenograft, this block here, and they're virtually absent from the tumor here. So you see some hints of mutation, which may suggest that they were present at very low prevalence. But I don't think we have enough cells to really say at what prevalence those were there. But the general structure of this that we inferred from bulk is very nicely capitulated in the single cell data. So this is a validation of the findings.
Of the algorithm.
Pardon me?
Of the algorithm.
Of the algorithm too, yeah. Yeah. So we weren't able to put this in the PyClone paper. We had this data, but it was reserved for this paper. So it would have made reviewers quite happy, I think, we had this data. But we struggled a little bit with PyClone. This is a nice validation of the algorithm. So that's the very simple case. What happens in the more complex case? Oh, sorry, this is really quite blurry. So what happens in the complex case is it would take a lot more time to explain this, except the fact that we see a pattern where, so here you have a set of, here are the germline polymorphisms again, here is the ancestral block, and then what you have is a successive accumulation of mutations downstream. So there's a bit of mutual exclusivity, okay? So here's a block of mutations represented by the orange clone, and that's this one here that essentially dies. It comes up and then it dies, and that's represented here. And if you look very closely here, in passage X2, we see the presence of this orange set of mutations. And then, so X2, there it is. It's prevalent at X2. And then it starts to die away. So by the time we hit X4, that set of mutations is completely absent. We just don't observe it at all. Okay. And maybe I can go through this first, and then I'll get your question. And then we have this set of mutations here, this light blue, and that's represented by this one here. Okay, so this is present everywhere. So this set of mutations present everywhere. And the assumption is that, in fact, the dark blue actually inherits from the light blue and then starts to take over. So here's the dark blue. And then the same thing happens, the green inherits from the dark blue, and then it takes over after that. And so by the time we hit X4, all of the cells essentially are represented by the green set of mutations. And so we have this nice hierarchical structure where you essentially have a chain of inheritance down here, and there's a branching point that separates the A and the B, the orange and the blue here. And so, if we were to model this, in fact, this is quantitative data. It's a nice schematic picture, but actually the number of cells actually corresponds to this axis here. So we start here at X1 with this distribution. We move to this distribution at X2, where you still have the orange is at low prevalence. It grows, and then it gets completely outcomputed by the time you hit X4. Okay, and that's actually what we observe in bulk.
I was just going to ask you, do you know what these genes do? Do you have a
sense for it? We do. We know what genes they fall into, but we really resisted the urge to interpret that because essentially we've got a series of n equals one observations then, and we don't see any sort of consistent genes that are driving growth expansion or associated with clonal expansion. It's only 15 cases that we looked at. So it, from that perspective, it's fairly limited in being able to interpret what the genes are actually doing. When we actually induce selective pressures and try to do systematic experiments in that way, where we know what the starting genotypes are, maybe we can start to make some ascertainment of function.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you take a ton of gene signatures that everybody likes to
take. Yeah.
You know, frequently, they're inexplicable. I mean, exactly what the gene is doing is actually very difficult to put into a context of what the adaptive strategy is.
Yeah. But we really resisted the urge. I think if we made a claim about that, it would just been crucified and justified the ceremony. There's no statistical power in there whatsoever.
And again, this is a story about that thing in skid mice.
Yeah.
I might have missed this part, but for each passage?
Yeah.
What was the time point at which you?
Oh,
them?
Yeah. So that's a good question. So they definitely grow across the patient sets. They grow at different rates,
do you have that?
Data? Have a time scale. Yeah, I can show you the.
So I guess what made so when you collected these guys, where they were all green versus mix of blue, green, and orange, right? From your color scheme at the bottom, was there a different size of the tumor, time to make that happen?
So I think they're all sacrificed according to the RAB requirements, so for humane treatment of the mice. So once the tumor got big enough, then we had to sacrifice. That's the determinant.
Yeah, have you looked at the correlates of that sacrifice time to this?
No.
Because that would be the underlying information
growth,
of how fast they were.
Yeah, so growth rate calculations, sure, that would be nice. Okay, so let's just summarize this part. And so what we observed is that across all 15 patients, actually, the tumor populations do exhibit a degree of clonal selection on engraftment. The selection patterns can vary as a function of serial passaging, so it's not stable over time. And then I think quite importantly is that these patterns were reproducible, and this does suggest deterministic causation, but we don't know the actual mechanism. And then I think from a methodological point of view, the statistical inference of clonal structure from bulk populations is really nicely capitulated in single cell sequencing. So I think this gets at some of the earlier discussion is, you know, what should we do? Should we do bulk? Should we do single cell? Should we do both? And my current intuition after doing the study is that both is required at this point, because the single cell data that we have in targeted sequencing is still quite noisy and takes quite a lot of statistical interpretation to really actually pull that signal. So that was left on its own and we didn't have a prior hypothesis as to what we might be looking for, it would be much more difficult to interpret. Okay, so how about tracking clonal expansions in space? So when I was on my daily walk here from the West Cottages, I came across this sign. It's an ecological study area, so I thought Bob would particularly appreciate this one.
Is that the nude beach back there?
I had my clothes on, I don't know.
That was your reason to have a camera.
Yeah, that's right.
Bob!
Just in case I caught somebody. Yeah.
This is being taped.
So this is now moving from time to space, okay? So this study involves high-grade serous ovarian cancers, and these are a subtype of ovary cancers and represent about 70% of the population, and they're by far the worst performers, so they have extremely poor five-year survival rate. They have an initial response to platinum taxane-based therapy, but almost 80% will recur. Highly metastatic disease, and we know for a long time that p53 mutations and BRCA abnormalities leading to homologous recombination deficiency and anti-apoptotic characteristics are really the dominant molecular features of the disease. So what we've engaged in is actually looking at different habitats, if you will, of the tumor, and by at the time of surgical staging, collecting specimens that are in different metastatic sites, and also in very large volume tumors, looking at different parts of the same tumor. And this is very analogous, probably, to what Marco Gerlinger maybe talked about last week, but just in a different disease. So one of the reasons I'm quite interested in this disease is that it is the disease of structural and genomic instability. It is the boss disease of that phenotype. And so in terms of looking at the TCGA synthesis, here's ovary over here as the percentage of tumor types that are copy number alterers rather than point mutation alterers, if you will. And so this has by far the most copy number changes of any of the diseases that have been looked at so far for TCGA. And here's just an example, here's a spectral karyogram of just how aneuploid these cases can be. And so you'd expect, these are chromosomal painting assays where you expect basically two copies of each color, and you can see that there's tetraploidy going on, there's all kinds of translocations, exchanges of information. These genomes are massively scrambled. And so how this relates to clonal diversity, even prior to selective pressures induced by therapy, is a major question that I'm quite interested in. So we engaged in this in the study, and I just wanted to reinvoke some phylogenetic modeling assumptions that, in fact, Ben alluded to some of these. The first is that if we take this tree, there's a general consensus that so-called driver alterations, and I know it's a loaded term this week as it should be, that they'll happen on the trunk of the tree. So that all cells will actually contain these driver alterations because they're actually responsible for the initial malignant transformation. The second is that the infinite sites and mutations only occur once along the tree. I completely agree with the point mutation discussion that was going on this morning, but from a gene perspective, actually, which is a lot of the times these are interpreted from gene perspectives, I wanted to look at whether this is actually in fact the case. And then the third is that mutations actually persist over evolutionary history, so you may have heard of the perfect and persistent phylogeny. So we can ask questions as to whether this is true. So the study design here is to actually collect these samples. We have about 16 patients done now. We've collected the samples, and we've done some degree of sequencing. And so DNA extraction, and six cases we've done whole exome, 10 cases whole genome, And then we invoked the same type of methodology that I showed you before, targeted deep sequencing on a panel of mutations, clonal population structure inference, and then single cell biologies. And so the first effort involved these six exomes. And I think this is really a proof of principle. This is a pilot study where we're showing mutations in blue, presence of mutation in blue, and then here are the samples. And then the mutations are just these columns here. And what you can essentially see is that there's always a set of shared mutations. So we had this really interesting case yesterday presented where we had this kind of polyclonal, potentially originating tumor in the bilateral breast cancer. When we see bilateral ovary disease, it's always clonal. We see a shared set of mutations. Here's P53, it's shared everywhere, and so it's one of the ancestral mutations. But then we see after the accumulation of these ancestral mutations, there's a fair amount of divergence. Here we have two samples. If you just look at these two rows, where they're actually adjacent to each other in the left ovary here. And you can see there's really considerable divergence happening. So these are really spatially almost adjacent. And you can see that there's a clone here that has acquired these mutations and they're completely absent here and vice versa. And so in summary, just in this pilot, I'm not gonna dwell on this too much because this is published data, is that about half the mutations are present in all samples. A P53 was always in all samples, so that really cements this idea that it's the initiating event in this disease. Incidentally, 97% of high-grade serous ovarian cancers possess a P53 mutation. It's the defining feature of the disease. And then there was some variation in how well conserved mutations were overall.
If you took, so 5G is a lymph node metastasis.
Yes.
Could you take all lymph node metastasis across patients and look at that group and see what are the similarities? Is there a lymph node adaptive landscape in which they're all responding essentially to the same genetic pathway?
Yeah, so we're almost, so me personally, I'm at the behest of the surgeon here. Mm-hmm. So whatever the surgeon can collect is what I study. And it's not very systematic. It's not very directed in that way. We do happen to have, in the next series I'll show you, a number of cases of omental metastases. And the omentum is quite interesting because it's a different soil, if you will. And so, but we still don't have the numbers. I mean, I'd love to do this in a few hundred cases and then we can actually talk about what might happen, but we don't have the numbers. Okay, so the first question, are driver alterations ancestral? So what we've done is, the really nice thing, bolstered by the first study, is that we thought, okay, well, that's nice. We know that there's a lot of diversity. Let's actually measure it with the genome, because there's actually many, many more data points that can be used. And so here what we've done is actually infer a phylogeny from mutation profiles from these different samples. So this is patient one. This is an omental metastases, a small bowel metastases, and four samples from the right ovary. And so we can fit a phylogenetic tree from these mutations, and we use a stochastic Dolo process for that. And so the leaves of the trees here are the samples, and not the clones. So that's a bit of a distinction from what we might have heard this morning. So we're just trying to relate samples together, and here we can see quantitatively that the metastatic samples in this patient are quite divergent from the right ovary sample. So there's a bifurcation here where this clade represents the right ovary, the primary site, and then this clade is quite a distinct departure from that clade. And then we can label the nodes on this tree and ask with the stochastic Dolo, where are mutations born along the tree? And so here we see that 3,000 mutations are ancestral, and then we see some variation as to where other mutations are born here. If you take the sum of these, actually there are more mutations that are not in the root node than actually are in the root node. So there's a fair amount of divergence that happens. So we can compare, these are point mutations. You can also, the nice thing about genome data is we actually, and the fact that this is a disease of structural alterations, we can actually look at breakpoints as well.
Actually, I'm sorry, I'm not.
Yeah.
Billy has a question. Technical question, because so the actual mutation numbers that you get are not terrible. Let's say you can have a breast cancer with 100,000 mutations. But you said that you have a huge amount of cognitive variation. Do you worry that that affects your SNP recovery, SNP recovery rate?
I'll show you something about that.
I was wondering whether it would be possible to move these counts onto the tree and give us a sense of how many mutations there are on each of these branches. Is that a question that?
Yeah, we can actually. That's, I mean, that's essentially what this data is showing, exactly that. So it's a green goes with green, white and white.
So when you put them on the node, you're putting it on the parental.
It's a branch. It's a branch. Yeah,
you're saying that those mutations have happened.
It's a branch. Yeah.
I mean, it might be instructive to redraw the tree with branch lengths proportional to these numbers, so you can sort of see where the rush of action is.
My brilliant student who's working on this is somehow reluctant to.
Interesting,
but I agree with you. maybe you can convince.
Yeah, send it my way.
I thought that's what you were showing. So the branch lengths.
No, the branch lengths are not meaningful here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so a couple of points. So one is that if we actually switch to breakpoints. So here, the actual tree doesn't change at all. So here we're actually measuring breakpoints. There are far fewer breakpoints, but it's still in the hundreds, and it actually recapitulates.
And even the relative heights of the histogram don't particularly change.
The scale's changing.
I understand.
Yeah, the relative
kind of blurry and toggle back and forth.
Yeah, it's pretty stable. So I think we're actually learning structure here, that's real. So from two very different perspectives, the mutation calling algorithm is something completely different than the breakpoint calling algorithm. It uses different parts of the data even in seeing. So that's quite robust. So let's just look at these branches. So I want to address the question about drivers on the trunk. So here's an example of a situation where we get a really bona fide driver. So here's a copy number profile. The arcs just represent predicted rearrangements. And so here's a homozygous deletion of CDKN2A. It's actually quite relevant to the glioblastoma folks, so you guys know this gene quite well, P16 protein. It's not typically associated with high-grade serous ovarian cancer at all. In right ovary 3, there's a complete loss of CDKN2A. It's recapitulated in an expression profiling as well. So here's, this is just gene expression array data. This loss of the genomic material results in a loss of expression of that gene completely. And so this is a genotypic change, likely resulting in a phenotypic change, only in this site, and it's a well-known driver. It's this second most deleted gene in the genome. In cancers. So,
why is there this hypothesis that driver mutations are on the trunk? Where's that?
Tumorigenic driver, certainly. So typically, the supposition is that there's a line of thinking that if we can hit the trunk of the tree. So there's all this diversity, and sure. So there's a line of thinking that's emerging that you hit the trunk of the tree with some therapeutic, then you can actually wipe out all cells, right? But actually, they're really functionally relevant drivers if they're not on the trunk, not on the trunk of the tree. So maybe it's just a miscast question, but the idea is that certainly in the ovarian cancer community, there's this idea that we can just target the trunk. But if you target the trunk, you miss this, and that's not going to be very good. Yeah. Oh, good. Okay. So that's CDKN2A, major cancer gene deleted on the brain.
No, I don't know. I'm just surprised by the hypothesis that sort of like everything that made humans was sort of a long time ago, and nothing new is happening. It's kind of
it's a fair point. We could alter that. The observation, though, is
yeah, no, I think it's great.
Yeah. So, So then we have, in the same patient, actually, we have a series of translocations. So these, I don't know if you're familiar with these diagrams. These are Sirkos diagrams that array chromosomes around a circle and arcs between two different points represents a translocation between that chromosome and the other chromosome. And so here we have this MYLK locus. It's repeatedly hit by translocations in multiple samples. So here are the samples. Here are the translocations involving MYLK, and then the partner, its translocation partner, which is shown here at different points, and then the occurrence of that partner is shown as a function of the sample itself. So the one to focus on is this translocation of BCL6. I heard a little bit about BCL2 yesterday. BCL6 is another lymphoma driver gene that is upregulated through translocation of lymphomas. Again, typically not associated with ovary cancers, but here you have a massive overexpression of BCL6 in the small bowel, only in the small bowel, and that's exactly where this translocation takes place. So here's a potentially a phenotypic change that's happening along the branch.
So your hypothesis is that MYLK is not relevant as a gene, just because it has so many different partners, but that...
Yeah, I think that's, well, don't know in this case, but what the result of this is, or there's an association with massive overexpression of BCL6.
Right. So maybe it's the regulatory region.
It could be a promoter change. That would be the interpretation. So, and this is happening only in small bowel. So then we can ask, okay, well, are these events exceedingly rare, or does it happen often? We have really interpretable cancer genes that are being altered on the branches. So we looked at another case. This is patient 9. This case has two omental metastases, a right ovary sample and two left ovary samples. And this is what the tree looks like, and that same distribution. So here's ERBB2. So this is was referred to in yesterday's case as well. Again, this is a gene that's highly amplified in about 15% of breast cancers. It defines a subtype of breast cancers that's targetable in the clinic. This case has four samples with high-level amplification of ERBB2, and then this sample here is complete absence. We validated this with FISH, and so here you can see the fluorescence of ERBB2 lights up in these samples. It's not lighting up here at all. So there's no red here, but there's lots of red everywhere else. So that's quite interesting. So now we can draw ERBB2 as happening on this branch of the tree because it's completely absent in left ovary 1. So if you look at this tree, this starts to raise something of interest in terms of phylogenetic modeling. So here we have no actual link between left ovary 2 and left ovary 1. And that suggests that aside from the mutations that are shared everywhere, they shouldn't share any mutations by this construction. Hopefully everyone can see that. So, but when we actually looked at the data, in fact, we saw that there were plenty of mutations here that were shared between left ovary 2 and left ovary 1, but were actually absent in the other sample. So here's right ovary 1. What I'm showing here is actually the copy number inference of a major and minor allele across the genome. This is just chromosome 2. And so we started, you'll notice that a lot of these data points here lie along integer values. And so what suggests here is that there's two copies of the minor allele here, three copies of the major allele, and over here you have two copies of both. Down here, you have something similar, and everything sort of projects nicely onto integer values. Here you have non-integer values, and so we started scratching our heads about this. Well, maybe they're actually probably two clones existing here in this sample. So we wanted to validate this, and we did deep sequencing on those mutations, and this is what the result was. So these are a representation of pi clone clusters again, where the different colors represent mutation clusters. They don't have anything to do with this tree. So here we have the ancestral clone that's present at high levels in left ovary 1, left ovary 2, and right ovary 1. We have this green clone here that's present at high levels in right ovary 1, but absent in left ovary 1. And then we have this pink cluster that's present at high levels in left ovary 1, but absent in right ovary 2. So then we look at leftover E2, and we see that actually pink is present at sort of moderate prevalence, and green is present at moderate prevalence. And so the idea is that leftover E2 probably is harboring both clones here. And one is maybe migrating over here, and one is migrating over there. So then we validated this with single cell sequencing. It's a similar type of diagram to what I showed before. But the important thing here is that, so here we have a genotype that's associated with the pink, and that typically travels red cells that are only from the leftover E1. And then we have this genotype here that's associated with green, and that's associated with the right over E1. And then we have intermixed cells from the leftover E2 that represent both genotypes. And then we also did targeted sequencing of the ERBE2 breakpoints, and they travel with this genotype here, which is associated with this leftover E2. So on balance, and I can see attention starting to wane here, so I'm going to just sort of skip through, is that we can start to reconstruct exactly how clones arose in this particular tumor. So we have acquisition of ERBE2 along this branch, and that travels with these mutations, these blue mutations. That clone is present in the omental metastases, the right ovary one, and also in the left ovary two. And you have a really dramatically different branch, clade here, that populates, it dominates left ovary one and has some representation in the left ovary two. So you can start to actually get at the clonal composition of each of these sites, and maybe even track one hypothesis that could be generated from this is that we have emergence of this clone here in leftover E2, and then it goes and actually metastasizes to the other locations. And because it has this high this driver gene that we all know about, that's the sort of hypothesis that we're leaning towards. Okay, so I'm going to take. I'm going to go through this and just talk about for the last bit about alterations occurring only once in the phylogeny, because I think this has come up a few times, and I'd like to show some data that suggests some interesting properties. So this is not SNV data. This is actually or point mutation data. This is actually copy number data now and rearrangements. So here's a location of the genome. It's 6 megabases on chromosome 19. This is patient 2 again, 2 omental metastases and 2 right ovary samples. So the right ovary samples have what's shown here is again the major minor copy number, and then the vertical lines here represent breakpoints that are predicted from the genome sequencing data. Here's cyclin E1. Cyclin E1 is amplified in about 15% of high grade serous ovarian cancers. It's quite important because it's actually mutually exclusive to BRCA. So no cases with BRCA germline or somatic mutation harbor these amplifications. So you're going back to Venn's sort of mutual exclusivity, we might interpret that this is actually quite important. And in fact, it's now being developed as a therapeutic target in this disease because of the amplification level. So anyways, it's an important gene in the disease. Here we have a series of breakpoints that are shared primarily between right ovary 1 and right ovary 2, and that's driving an amplification. So here, in this case, you have about 25 copies of the gene. Here you have about 15 copies of the gene. Over here, you have amplification of the gene, so in sum total, we get about 10 copies of the gene. But the breakpoints are non-overlapping. So they're completely, almost completely mutually exclusive. And so when we go back to the phylogeny, do I have the phylogeny for that? I don't. But if you were to draw the phylogeny, you see branches from omentum 1 and omentum 2 that group these together, and right over E1 where the two are grouped together. And so that really does suggest independent acquisition of these amplification of cyclin E1 along the tree. And so this is an example of what you might call convergent evolution. And because we know, again, we have some biology to layer interpretability on this, one could actually take the next step and say, well, that's being selected for independently in two different populations.
So
they do share, or do they share the same SMB, and that is then being just amplified in a different way in these branches? So is that SMB actually in the single amount?
So the SMB, there's a matter of mutation is important here. This is just the locus of the gene.
So you don't have to mutate anything, you just have to gain copies.
It's just have to gain copies.
Okay.
But we know that these share, for example, the same p53 mutation. So they're clonally related.
Yeah.
But then they independently acquire amplification of cyclin.
So in the desire to interpret this and tell the story, so you focus one hypothetical driver gene. But presumably there are many more.
There are
so
many
of the
genes.
Suppose we were to put all the sort of little red squares, all the candidates that we can find in some database, wouldn't it be rather dense?
So this is just a six megabase portion of the genome here. It's quite focal, actually. So this isn't the whole genome. But there are still other genes in this region. So it's probably about 12 genes that are in here, maybe more, maybe 20 at most. But cyclin E through functional studies, this is the target. It's almost, it could be something else, but it's very unlikely, given what we know about.
Could it be more than one thing?
Could be more than one thing. Could be co-amplification of neighboring genes, absolutely. Yeah. Okay. So. The other side, and we validated this with deep sequencing, so we don't dwell on that. So the other side of it is what happens when you have convergent losses. So here's a germline variation in RAD51 base. This is inherited. This is a gene involved in homologous recombination, the same pathway as BRCA. And this is a splice site variant in this patient. It's heterozygous in the normal genome of this patient. Here you have loss of the wild type allele in the tumor, and this is in a brain metastasis here from this patient. This one actually has serial biopsies, so it's a brain metastasis, and then there's a recurrence in the pelvis there. So we have loss of the wild type allele rendering this mutant RAD51 homozygous, and the same thing happens over here. In the second recurrence, but it's by different breakpoints. So again, we potentially have a hypothesis that this is happening independently. Oh, Chris maybe has a different explanation, but maybe that this is this happened and then we had it just got subsumed by this one, which is possible as well. But this points to the potential that convergent evolution is happening. So let me just finish then by saying, I think we've really proven that clonal diversity is a major feature of this disease prior to treatment. Most of these samples, with the exception of the last one, are untreated samples. That these types of driver alterations can often occur after expansion of the ancestral clone. I didn't show this, but the copy number deletion we find in this disease is a frequent mechanism of actually removing mutations. So this violates the persistence hypothesis, and we see multiple examples of this. We see examples of convergent evolution, and I think that the lesson that we can take away from this is that traditional phylogenetic modeling assumptions certainly will apply generally in this disease. Maybe in other diseases, but I expect that even in other diseases it will be violated. So the work I do is inherently team science, and so Jessica is a surgeon, David is a pathologist, Sam is a molecular biologist, and Blake is a pathologist, and so this team is really responsible for generating a lot of the data that I've shown you. And these four fine folks are the students in my group who have done a lot of the heavy lifting and really driven some of the projects. And these are two postdocs in Sam Alfricio's group who did a lot of the work on the xenograft study. So with that, I'd like to just thank the funders and thank you for your attention, and I'll stop there.
So when you have a copy number, a deletion, a copy number loss that removes a mutation, does that preferentially or even exclusively happen with mutations that are loss of function? because the direction of that would be the same as the loss of function, whereas if it was an oncogenic mutation, I mean, a gain-of-function mutation, you would now functionally have
so
the opposite
direction.
So
let me show direction. You, I skipped over this data, but I'm going to show you this data. So, okay, so here you have, this is more single-cell data, nuclei here in columns, for the purpose of illustration, just for a quick illustration, these are normal cells. These are tumor cells. And so so we looked at actually heterozygous SNPs in the normal, and that were LOH'd out in the tumor. So there's a deletion happening that's removing one allele. And so blue, solid blue represents that you've just got the remaining allele. And so here's chromosome 17, which is known to be clonally deleted. In one copy deleted in this disease. And you can see all the tumor cells have this dark blue pattern across this whole locus here. Here's another locus on chromosome 7 that has this dark blue pattern suggesting loss just in a proportion of cells. So these tumor cells don't have it. It happens to correspond with loss of XRCC2 mutation. So this is XRCC2 is also involved in homologous recombination. It's a well-known functional mutation. And so here you have a complete, a partial, a mostly co-occurrence of this loss of this region which harbors this mutation,
yeah,
and lack of the mutation. So we think in this case, in fact, that loss is actually removing the mutation.
But the mutation itself is a loss of function mutation in XRCC4.
XRCC2?
XRCC2, sorry.
It was a point mutation, but its function is known to abrogate homologous recombination.
Right, so it's a loss.
It's a loss of function.
So that makes sense.
So then those cells regain homologous recombination capacity. If that bears out to be true, then those cells would actually be able to restore homologous recombination and actually would have much more stable genomes going forward.
Now, why do you, I'm confused now. I mean, they had a loss of function mutation and now they've lost the gene.
They've lost the mutant allele.
But the
wild type allele.
They always had the wild type allele. So unless the mutant was functioning as a dominant negative, they always had that capacity.
Yeah, true. But the mutant allele is gone in those cells. So whatever phenotype is induced by that mutant allele is potentially reversed.
Yeah, I'm thinking you. What I'm suggesting is, I wonder if you ever get reversion or reversal, that losing something that's already non-functional.
Yes, you
not
do.
A
so,
change in status.
So yeah. So in fact, BRCA germline mutations can revert in the tumor. So you have a frame-shifting germline mutation inherited, and a somatic mutation to restore reading frame in the tumor. That's what gets selected in the presence of genotoxic therapy. So it's advantageous for those cells to restore
their
homologous recombination. So this is an analog of that.